Sairam, dear listeners, welcome to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai with Arvind. Before we begin, we offer our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We have much to thank him for, but today's satsang also is going to talk about one reason why we really have to be grateful to him. But before I do that, let me also welcome Arvind to join me in this discussion. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem, and this discussion that we are going to have today on pilgrimages, on the purpose behind a pilgrimage, why a pilgrimage, I'm sure it's going to be very refreshing, and I'm sure it will leave us inspired at the end, thanks to the many inputs that Swami has given on this very same topic. This is a month of pilgrimages, if we can call so. Even as we are speaking here, we have just witnessed the conclusion of one tremendous pilgrimage happening in the heart of India, in the state of Maharashtra. This is the month of Ashadh, according to the Indian calendar. And in Ashadh comes Ashadi Ekadashi, which is a fantastic pilgrimage. The pilgrimage begins from all corners of Maharashtra, and the people who love, adore and worship God in the form of Mahavishnu, particularly in the form of Vithala, for them this is a grand, glorious festival. This is the time when, you know, a kind of literal pilgrimage, if I can say so, because people don't make use of trains, cars or railways. They literally walk. People walk from different parts of Maharashtra to Pandharpur in what is known as the Warkari tradition. So they come to Pandharpur on the banks of river Chandrabhaga to offer their obeisance to Lord Vithala. Vithala, who is a form of Lord Vishnu. And these pilgrimages, as I said, begin from different parts of Maharashtra, with each place being the place of a saint. For example, Saint Jnaneshwar from Alandi. So there is a procession with a palanquin bearing Saint Jnaneshwar, and the people set out from Alandi towards Pandharpur. Similarly, from the place of birth and residence of Namdev, Tukaram, Gajanan Maharaj, Eknath, from Paithan, you know, that is the village of Eknath. Mm-hmm. So from all these places, holding a palanquin of these saints, you know, symbolic of these saints also doing the pilgrimage, and all the other pilgrims making this pilgrimage along with these saints. So it's a virtual conglomeration of saints, because all, I named only five, when I checked, there were more than 10 to 15 such saints. Maharashtra is blessed with an abundance of saints. So all of these start and they culminate at Pandharpur. And there's a grand congregation on the banks of river Chandrabhaga. And the name of Lord Vithala reverberates every atom in the air. And it's a fantastic experience to be there during this time. So, as I said, it is apt to speak about pilgrimages, because we have just concluded a pilgrimage like this. And you know, for us Sai devotees, Vithala, be it Shiva, be it Durga, anybody, be it Jesus, be it Allah, for one who is devoted to Swami, who loves Swami, Swami is all of these. And therefore, it is not surprising that the Sri Sathya Sai organizations from Maharashtra, they make a pilgrimage to Prashanthi Nilayam during this month. And we recently witnessed programs that they put up for Ashadi Ekadashi in the Sai Kulwant Hall. So their Pandharpur is Puttaparthi, and their Chandrabhaga is Chitravati. So they definitely come here. Incidentally, you know, somebody, a Kannada dramatist, mm-hmm. I forget his name, he is a great writer also. I think it is Mr. Dr. Bendre.
Okay.
He said that, you know, Pandharpur, Swami is definitely like Vithala, because Pandharpur means, Pandhara is meaning white, mm-hmm. and Pura means a field of action, Kshetra. So Pandharpura, white, also translates as white field. And so he said, okay, just like Vithala is the Lord of Pandharpur, we have Swami who is the Lord at Whitefield in Bangalore, the ashram. So he had said that our Vithala is Swami. And that is what the devotees and pilgrims feel as they make this journey from Maharashtra to Puttaparthi every year during the month of Ashad for Ashadi Ekadashi.
Very true. In fact, I think right now the Dandi procession, as it's called, I think the devotees from Maharashtra come during Ashadi. They do it from as close as Dharmavaram. And there's the reason for it. If you wonder why the Varkari tradition actually has a longer trek of a few kilometers to a few hundred kilometers to Pandharpur. In fact, till quite probably 15-20 years ago, in the mid-90s, there was a Varkari group which used to come walking all the way from Pune and Bombay.
That's nearly 1,000 kilometers.
It used to take them months to come, and I happened to meet one of those people who was part of it. And it was eventually stopped by Swami because I think they met with an accident once on their way. And Swami said, it is enough, don't do it anymore. They do it only from Dharmavaram now. But imagine, you know, they would start from Bombay, Pune, wherever they were from. I don't know exactly where they started from. But they would walk all the way. And they had a lot of very strict disciplines they used to have for themselves. They used to have this huge push cart, which would serve as their altar, at the same time the place where they would keep their provisions and their luggage. And they used to keep pushing that all the way, singing bhajans and like almost like a palanquin procession all the way from the place where they started. And they would not eat anywhere in any hotel. That was a self-discipline they had. They would either stop along the way and some samitis used to offer them prasadam, which they would accept, or in the highway wherever they were, not in a village or a town, they would cook their own food. And that's how they would come. And invariably, I think it never happened that they came on a pilgrimage like that and they did not get a interview from Swami.
Naturally, I mean, you know, the sheer effort in itself is phenomenal. And one would feel that anybody putting in such an effort will definitely be rewarded with an interview from Swami. But it's amazing. I just can't imagine myself walking even from Dharmavaram. I know for sure, you know, some of the people whom I know have also done this on quite a few occasions. I think my mother has done this, and she says they take a few days to do it. Every day they walk about 20 to 25 kilometers every day, which is pretty big distance, you know. It's not just walking. At a walking speed of about 4 kilometers an hour, you know, it'll take 6 hours to cover 24 kilometers. But your walking speed becomes even less because you're a big group and you're walking, singing bhajans. So when you get lost in singing bhajans, your walking speed reduces. Your focus is not on, you know, it's not like a marathon race that you're trying to complete. So it takes quite a lot of energy, time, commitment to do this. Even though it seems Dharmavaram to Puttaparthi is much, much, much less compared to Maharashtra to Puttaparthi. Dharmavaram to Puttaparthi, if you just travel in a local bus, you will realize it's quite a big journey to make, quite a long journey, so it's really admirable that they do that. You know, this month also happens to be the month of Ramzan, and our Muslim brethren, they have been observing their rituals and rites during this season. You know, one thing that comes of all these is you wonder, why has this been set up like this? You know, all the religions have certain days as important days. All the religions recommend a pilgrimage. They say if not once a year, you should do this at least once in a lifetime. The Muslims have this Hajj pilgrimage. The Christians too go to the Holy Land. And of course, among the Indians, yes, we have not one, but several pilgrimage centers associated to different forms. Not only there is a pilgrimage center for Vishnu, there are pilgrimage centers for different forms of Vishnu. That is what we were speaking about, Vithala in Maharashtra. There are pilgrimage centers for Shiva, for the Devi, for Ganesha, for Subramanya, for, you know, for each god there is a pilgrimage center. And you know, in India we also have this tradition like what we call as the family deity. And you know, for example, my own family deity, though it is a representation of one of the major deities, that is either Shiva or Vishnu, I exactly don't know, because this is some kind of a, like how we have multiple dialects in the same language, like that the same form of the Lord has many different little avatars now and then that have come. So if we go that way, there are so many gods. I think there was an estimate of, I don't know if it's 33 lakh or 33 crore.
Swami used to say 33 crores.
33 crore gods, and
right.
No wonder every 3-4 families will have one family god. So, if not anything, it is said that in your lifetime, you must make a pilgrimage to visit your family deity. For many families, their family deity is Tirupati Balaji. In the same way, there's a Subramanya, that is Lord Kartikeya in Karnataka. So different families have family deities. So whether it is a family deity or your lord or whatever, whether it's you're a Hindu, a Christian, a Muslim, whatever, we see this concept of a pilgrimage where you have to set out from your home or place of residence and travel to the place of residence of God, observing some disciplines and following certain procedures. We find this as a common thing among all religions, races, and among all people. The question that arises is, what is so special about a pilgrimage? Why is it that every religion seems to be recommending one?
You're talking about deities, because it's so interesting. As you said, we all know that God is one. We've been brought up to believe that way. We still worship different deities. But at the end of the day, when you say, this is my family deity and this is my Ishta Devata, there is a certain kind of personalization of that divinity which happens, which is very, very essential for a devotee, right? Mm. It's so important for the devotee to feel that this is my God. Even though you know that this is the same God who's, you know, the master of the cosmos, but you feel that this is my God, this is my family's God. You know, you kind of have that personal rapport with that that form. But talking about deities, you're talking about deities, but in India we even worship the inanimate objects, right? We worship rivers, we worship mountains, we worship, of course we worship representations of divinity, but we even worship these naturally occurring objects, right?
No, in fact, we, instead of treating God as stone, we treat a stone as God, as they say. That is why you see the river Ganga is considered as Ganga Devi. There's a temple for river Ganga. You know, Kaveri, there's a river, there's a temple for river Kaveri. And Kaveri is considered as a goddess. A goddess, I don't know if she is, in the sense, affiliated to Parvati or to Lakshmi. Because, you know, it is believed that originally there are three goddesses. That is Saraswati, that is goddess of wisdom, Durga or Parvati, that is Shakti, energy. And, of course, there is Lakshmi of prosperity and wealth. So, all other representations of the goddesses are considered as derivatives of one of these. And so, even the rivers are supposed to be one of these three goddesses. So, in fact, each river is a goddess who is worshipped. Any river in India, if you go, there will be a temple dedicated to that river where it is worshipped. So, though it is supposed to be an inanimate object, it is not considered inanimate. It is given the form of a god or a goddess. There are very few masculine rivers in India, but they are considered as gods. I remember there is the river Krishna, the river Bhima in South India. You know, these are some of the masculine rivers which are considered as divine beings, and the feminine rivers are all considered as goddesses. So what you say is absolutely true. And even what you said previously about the personal touch with the family deity, probably one reason why I'm not able to remember the exact name of my family deity is, as a child I was introduced to Swami, and somehow it was built into me that my family deity is Swami. So now if somebody asks me what's your family deity, I say Swami is my family deity. And because of that, the personal connection has happened, the bonding has happened with Swami. So Swami is my family deity. But in the beginning I just mentioned that to show that it's not as if just because the avatarhood has happened and Swami has come that we have a family deity. Even before the physical arrival of Swami, there have been family deities, and there has been this kind of personal god for every person in India.
Very true. In fact, these family deities are very, very small and obscure shrines. Most of us would not have heard of the other person's family deity.
Hmm.
But talking about these rivers, I'm reminded, I think in 88 when Swami was in one of the discourses, Swami was talking about devotion. I think it was a discourse on the 5 D's. In that, Swami was defining each of those D's like duty, discipline. When he came to devotion, the definition which Swami gave was very, very different, at the same time very profound. When Swami said, you know, always you think of devotion as you praising the Lord in seeking something in return.
Mm.
Right? You think that you are worshipping God, you're praising him so that when you have some problem, you will actually receive it return. But Swami went on to say very beautifully, he said, all of devotion, what you do as bhajans, what you do as seva, what you do as worship of any kind, is nothing but expression of gratitude. He said it's not something which is done seeking something in the future, but it is something which is done thanking what has been received. I mean, it's a very beautiful perspective because, you know, when do you offer gratitude? Like, suppose you do me a favor and I do a return favor, which means I'm getting even with you, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting something for what I've done now, right? So that is why Swami said that all expressions of devotion, be it bhajans or seva, should be done as gratitude. You don't do it thinking that, you know, I'm doing your work, Swami, you do my work. Or I'm doing this so that in future when I need, you'll come to me. Swami is saying that all devotion is actually an expression of gratitude for what is being received. And in that context, it's not surprising that we worship the rivers. Because it is an expression of gratitude. And I think that is why that one episode which is there in Krishna's life is very significant. The Govardhanagiri episode. Because there, the people were worshipping Indra the god. Okay, and in the process of worshipping Indra the god, that devotion or that prayer was becoming, was bordering in that fear and, you know, awe of the Lord. And I think what Krishna was trying to do, Lord Krishna was trying to do, is trying to drive this message home that worship should be based on gratitude. So he said it is better to worship the Govardhanagiri and say thank you for whatever you're given, rather than worshipping Lord Indra and saying that if I don't worship him, he's going to throw his wrath on me.
Exactly. When you were saying that, you know, when we worship rivers, it's an expression of gratitude. It is natural because if we look at all the major cities in the world today, all of them are on the banks of a river, which is not surprising because civilization always happens on the banks of rivers.
Right.
Even if we look at medieval civilizations or even ancient civilizations, all have been on the banks of river because it all starts with water. Whether it's growing crops, whether it's industry, whether it is whatever that one has to do, one needs water. And so therefore rivers are life. And it is but natural that we have to express our gratitude because what we have received nourishment from the river spans centuries. Not only we are receiving, our forefathers have received, our generations before have received. And that's why, you know, when we realize the meaning of worship as an expression of gratitude, our actions also change because if I am truly grateful to a river, I will not be polluting it. I will not be pouring my drains right into it. I will not think that it is expensive to treat the drainage. I can rather save money by just dumping it into the river. One gets the feeling, you know, when the river becomes a deity, you get the feeling that I am just pouring this acid onto my goddess, onto the figure that I worship.
Right.
So that is why the other important thing is we really not only do this as a rote, but also understand the spirit so that it, and finally if you see, you know, when we do all this, it benefits us only. The river actually looks for no benefit. Whether you put untreated sewage or treated sewage, it is still sewage. The river is still bearing the burden. But by putting treated sewage, we are prolonging the life of the river and thus prolonging our own life. That is the beauty of all these spiritual practices. Though in the beginning it appears as if we are doing it for somebody else's uplift and benefit, in the ultimate analysis we realize that it is 100% for our own benefit, and so too it holds with pilgrimages. We don't do pilgrimages for anybody else's benefit nor for making the Lord happy. I'm saying this because recently someone said that you should definitely go and, you know, see your family deity. Mm-hmm. I'm meaning that family deity who is before Swami, right. If I can say so, like before Christ, they say, like I'm saying before Swami. And there is this fear that if you don't go and see your family deity will be upset with you. So when that is said like that, it makes you feel as if you are making the pilgrimage for the sake of your family deity, for the sake of God. But in the ultimate analysis, as I said, like in the river, we realize that when we make a pilgrimage also, it's for our own benefit. And I think our satsang from now on will show us how every pilgrimage is ultimately for our own benefit.
Very true. But before we move on, even as we are talking about worshipping rivers, maybe this month has also been marked by a very, very special worship, which is the Pushkaram festival, which was held in the banks of Godavari, right? Which was interestingly talking about, you were saying about deities being, rivers being worshipped as deities. And according to this Pushkaram tradition, it's a festival which is basically celebrated to celebrate rivers. So in India, in the Bharat continent, it is believed that there are 12 very sacred rivers, which are given the primary position. I don't know exactly what are they. Of course, Ganga, Saraswati, Yamuna, and
Godavari, Narmada,
Krishna,
Krishna,
and all
Kaveri.
Of these, 12 of these rivers. And each of these rivers have a zodiac sign which is associated with that particular river. Hmm. So there are 12 rivers and 12 zodiac signs. And depending on which zodiac sign Jupiter is in that year.
Guru.
Right. Guru spends 1 year in a zodiac sign. So depending on which zodiac sign that Jupiter is in that year, that river gets the Pushkaram worship.
For the benefit of our overseas listeners, the planet Jupiter is called as Guru in Sanskrit.
Or Brihaspati.
Or Brihaspati.
Right.
And again, it's very significant because in a day, tomorrow we will be celebrating a day in praise and worship of the Guru.
Right. So this Pushkaram happens, like if you go to Godavari, it happens once in 12 years. If you go to Ganga, it happens once in 12 years. But the interesting thing about this Pushkaram which happened is, once in 12 Pushkarams is a Mahapushkaram.
Hmm.
So this Mahapushkaram which happened in Godavari is like once in 144 years.
12 into 12, yes.
Right, so it's very, very sacred, and you can imagine that probably not one individual will see two Pushkarams in his lifetime. Unless, you know, medicine improves so much. So it's a very sacred event, and it was believed that close to a crore people have gathered there. And of course, it's the other thing which is very, very heartening for us is the kind of phenomenal seva that our seva dal from the Andhra Pradesh and Telangana region did over there. I mean, it's mind-blowing the amount of work they did, because all the 17 districts of Andhra Pradesh and Telangana had their seva dal there. Not less than 15,000 sevadal were on duty there.
Wow. Just to put things in perspective,
right.
You know, 15,000 sevadal is more than the people, if the whole of Sai Kulwanthal and Purnachandra Auditorium is filled up, even then it will not be 15,000 people.
If you come to Puttaparthi, you see sevadal all around the place. And at best, there are 1,500 sevadal at duty in the ashram and the hospital. During the peak times. Hospitals, everything put together. All the other places in and around Puttaparthi, everything put together, there are 1,500 sevadal. There were 15,000 on duty during the Pushkaram. You know, those 12 days. It's a 12-day worship. And they were cooking all through the day. They were, you know, giving prasadam all through the day. They were having wheelchairs. They were helping the young and old.
Just, it will be amazing for us to feel the thrill. If you can just go through each one thing that they have done at the Pushkaram, because, you know, even though 15,000 is a very big number, when you're talking of 1 crore people, I mean, 15,000 is nothing, because 15,000, then you, 1 crore is 10 million, right? Or is it 100
right,
million?
Right,
10 million.
Right.
So, where is 15,000, where is 10 million? And really, all the buses in the state were diverted from the government side, I'm saying, towards Pushkaram, and all the trains had been diverted towards that side. So while transport had been taken care, I don't think any of those cities where this Pushkaram, any of those towns where the Pushkaram took place would be adequately geared for a Mahapushkaram, because every year, every 12 years when Pushkaram itself takes place, I think a dozen years ago when it had taken place, that time also, the Sevadal volunteers from the state of Andhra Pradesh and Telangana did yeoman service there. But this time would have been a real, real, real challenge with 1 crore people.
Right, absolutely. And they took what was the most important tasks in a gathering like that. Of course, they were serving food throughout the day. They were giving prasadam all through the day. Anybody could come. In fact, they started serving even in the lines. Instead of expecting people to come to their counters, they started going into the lines and serving. Then they had wheelchairs, which was so very important. You know, they're helping people. Because you can imagine that from the place where your bus or your train drops off to the banks of the river, it must have been quite a distance.
Few kilometers sometimes.
Right. And they also had Sevadal in the ghats, in the waters, helping old people, you know, take the dip and go back. That was, again, nobody else was there. Nobody, I mean, you could have police people manning the security, but you won't have people doing such work, right? And definitely the shrines over there did not have personnel to do that kind of work. So these people are doing that, and apart from that, I think they were serving water throughout the day. They had so many sevatal going around. We've seen that here, you know, that backpack water service which they...
carries about 15 right? liters of water.
Right, and that was one thing which they did. And another very thoughtful seva which these people did was cloakroom seva.
Hmm.
Because it's a gathering so large and people will be coming in and going out so very often that they, at all the important places in the market, in the railway station, in the bus stands, in the makeshift bus stands, they had these cloakroom services where people could come and get their luggage and go finish their holy dip and then come back and leave immediately. And it was very, very heartening that after a few days, the police and the organizers started calling the sevadal and asking them to take more duties. Because mm-hmm. they found that this was such a disciplined lot, and there were people who were doing things so responsibly and with so much care. The officials themselves were inviting these people to come and take more charge. And I think people who would have seen reports of the Pushkaram itself in the new channels would have seen our sevadal everywhere, actually. I think no shot of the Pushkaram was without our sevadal with their trademark badges. And you could see even the police were letting the sevadal take the charge and, you know, arrange the things. So I'm sure Swami must have been really pleased with the work.
Definitely, it's a matter of great joy, because, you know, the other day I was reading about how you were speaking about people helping them to take a dip. It is so important, because these are not like swimming pools. These are not right. like man-made structures. These are rivers, and one can never say where it is slippery, where it is straight. The rocks, the contours underneath keep changing on a minute-to-minute basis.
Right.
So those who are little elderly definitely need help, and in such huge crowds. You know, the crowds are so huge that if you happen to fall in the river and get, and you're drowned, nobody may even notice, because there are thousands of people taking dip. I saw a report in the newspaper which said that all the local fishermen
mm-hmm.
had been employed by the government, and usually they make about 400 or 500 rupees a day selling fish.
Okay.
So they were told that these 12 days of the Pushkaram, please stop your fishing. Because all the fishermen are like expert swimmers.
Okay.
They were called to patrol the river
mm-hmm.
and they were paid, I think, 800 rupees a day or something like that. So many fishermen. So that is a big burden on the exchequer,
right.
you know, to pay like this, to pay people to do this. In such a scenario, people who are coming and willing to do without payment is rare. On top of that, coming in such large numbers, 15,000 volunteers is amazing. And the best of all, who are passionate and doing it with all their life.
Absolutely.
That is amazing.
I think one of the TV channels actually ran a report on the sevadal working there. And they interviewed an 85-year-old lady who was doing seva. They asked her, what can you do? I mean, in such a crowd, what are you doing? She said, yeah, last time when I came for Pushkaram seva, I was very active. This time I'm just cutting leaves for making plates. You know, that is the kind of seva. And to find so many people doing something without seeking anything in return, saying that, you know, this will make Swami happy and that's why we are here. I think probably that is the bedrock of everything. Whether we talk about pilgrimages, we talk about worship, we talk about anything. That is the bedrock of everything. And maybe before we move on from the rivers and the worship of rivers, one thing which I would like to talk about is, you know, generally people say that if you really believe that your rivers are so sacred, why do you litter it? Because of the amount of flowers and the worship material which is dumped into the river. I'm reminded of a lecture we had by a river expert, if you could say that. He was basically a water treatment expert who studied rivers across the world. I think there are no river in the world, major river in the world, whose water is not tested.
Hmm.
And that's his achievement. So he was telling that a lot of people say that the rivers of India are polluted because of this kind of worship. He said there's nothing which can be more untrue than that, because these are worships which have been going on for centuries. If this was what was polluting the river, this river should have been polluted 200 years ago.
Correct.
He said, in fact, if you really observe that this kind of worship is reduced, you know, even in the Ghats of Ganga, where they say the bodies are thrown into the water, all these things have reduced and the pollution has gone up. So don't blame your religious activity for the pollution of the river. It's clearly the dumping of the waste, as you said.
You know, it's the industrialization
right.
and so-called modern things that have actually killed the river. But it's always like that, Prem. You know, actually my blood boils and I get irritated when people speak about noise pollution and smoke on Deepavali. Right. 3 hours, one day a year, and you have so-called big people, so-called influential people coming and telling people that don't burst firecrackers, don't light crackers because the smoke pollutes. Throughout the year, you're belching out poisonous fumes into the atmosphere. Can't you go to work one day by walk, cutting your car down? No. Instead of all that, you know, I don't think all the firecrackers that a family bursts will be more polluting than a car running 10 kilometers. But nobody talks of that. Nobody sees that.
We spoke about the value of vegetarianism, we saw how much of pollution is caused by our eating habits.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So this is really a kind of, you know, very, very cheap of people to do that, you know, because they do not realize the other benefits of a festival. When everybody comes together in a world where a father is a stranger to his own son, a mother doesn't know her own child, where families are being torn asunder and ripped apart into nuclear families, in such a scenario, a festival where everyone comes together, it is a festival, a celebration of joy, unity, bonding. It's so amazing. These things that it's achieving at a emotional and a mental level are far great rewards that we get with a little smoke that is burst, you know. You waste water on golf courses and pour it out, and on holy day say don't throw 2 mugs of water. Ridiculous, ridiculous to say the least. You know, it's like one day when I was sitting in Kulwanthal, somebody came and said, you know, Baba says about saving energy, and what is this? He's putting so many chandeliers in Kulwanthal. You know, these kind of pseudo-secular, pseudo-scientific, I just felt like slapping that person, telling him, do you know the amount of joy this place is creating? No place on earth will have an equal proportion of joy being created with 100 chandeliers being on. With 100 chandeliers being on, 1,000 hearts are being lit here with such kind of love and devotion. If this kind is happening, then light chandeliers all over the place. You have such wasteful chandeliers. Recently, I had been to a resort. The next to that was a 5-star resort. Mm-hmm. And in the 5-star resort, you should see a swimming pool and lights are on. Nobody is in the pool. Throughout the night, it's on. Why? Just because it's a 5-star hotel, it's mandatory. Just because it's mandatory, it becomes fine. Shut the damn light over there and allow a chandelier to be lit in a temple. I mean, I feel before such cheap statements are made, we should definitely look at the results that are being achieved. So too, I feel, when tanneries are dumping in junk, chemical factories are polluting the rivers, you come and tell that you putting flowers, you throwing incense sticks, you immersing Ganesha idols is pollution. Really, really, one step short of slapping them on the face. I feel like slapping them with words.
Very true, Arvind. In fact, many of these points you've raised are things which we probably will try to deal with, because I think all this put together actually makes for a good pilgrimage. When you go there, there are so many factors which make for a pilgrimage, which actually contribute to it, which sometimes we give as reasons for not going on pilgrimages. The funny thing is that, but before we go to that, I think that's what we're going to talk. Maybe we'll set the mood by playing the bhajans recorded in our own studio to mark the Ashadi celebrations. You spoke about Eknath. This is a beautiful bhajan where Sant Eknath sings that Pandharpur is my mother's home. You know, that's how he sings it. And every moment I think of Pandharpur, the longing to go back to Pandharpur and see my mother and father, which is Vithala and Rakumai, you know, swells in my heart. A beautiful bhajan rendered in the voices of our own Ravi sir and brother Amai from the Institute, of course arranged by Anirudh.
Hari 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 Mahir Pandhari
Welcome back, dear listeners. We have started a pilgrimage on the significance of a pilgrimage. coming now to the topic proper, the question that is often asked, Prem, is, you see, God is everywhere. God is omnipresent, He's omnipotent, He's omniscient, and He's present in every atom of this universe. Then what is the need to travel to a particular place to see Him? In that sense, a pilgrimage doesn't make any sense. So, this is the question that is often asked. So I think that should be a good starting point for our discussion.
Absolutely. It should be a good starting point because, you know, as Swami says, that is the understanding we come to at the end of a pilgrimage, at the end of a spiritual journey. And I think we very often do this, I don't know about others, I can talk about myself, where we take what has got to be achieved at the end of a journey, at the end of your quest, we take that conclusion and try to fit it into every part of our life. And I think it leads to a lot of confusion. And this is precisely one of those things, because we say that God is everywhere. Do we live our life in that belief? Do we act every day as though Swami is standing beside us? No, we don't. You know, do we make every life choice and every life decision the way we speak to our parents, the way we speak to our spouses, the way we speak to our children? Do we always believe that Swami is standing beside me? No. But when it comes to something like a pilgrimage or something like, you know, doing an activity, we bring that understanding and put it in this and say that this looks meaningless.
I was reading about Ramzan, you know, as I said, this was a month of Ramzan. It is said that they observe the fast, they don't drink, they don't even drink their own saliva. Right. They don't eat food during the fast. And it is said that, you know, I was reading the Wikipedia page, it said that they have been told to abstain in the sense a husband doesn't touch his wife, a wife doesn't touch her husband during this period, and apart from that, they are told to refrain from all bad activities, you know, like gossiping, criticizing, which means that other days you may be doing these, but during this time you better not do it. I'm sure even in every pilgrimage when we do, see, when we have this pilgrimage that people do to Shabrimala, they put on the mala.
Right.
So there are some things, they don't eat food cooked by others.
Right.
There
they
are
don't
so many.
Smoke. I mean, even there, I think all these things are there.
Yes, the smokers give up smoking.
Right.
So, you know, it's what you said just now that when people say God is everywhere, do we lead every moment of our lives as if God is every time with us? We see the difference, the way we behave in Swami's presence. Probably in Swami's interview room, is so different compared to how we behave elsewhere. You know, in Swami's presence, for example, we would see that never there'll be any kind of interaction between the ladies and the gents. But as a small example, I'm saying, I have seen in some of the centers, do we at every center itself, forget at home, at every center do we follow this? Don't we see that gents and ladies sometimes talk and I'm not saying it's unnecessary talk, it might be important, but it happens in public, where the gent just crosses over to the lady side and speaks and comes, or the lady crosses over to the gent side, speaks and comes. It would never happen in Swami's presence. So, what I'm saying is, even in a place which is supposed to be a Sai center, sometimes these things are violated. And therefore, as you said, it would be hypocritical to say that God is everywhere, why do we need to do a pilgrimage? Because when I make a pilgrimage, consciously I imbibe and do those things which will please the Lord. I consciously start living my life as if God is watching me every moment, at least during the pilgrimage. So I think a pilgrimage is what gives us a first taste of what it means to live in the omnipresence, because it makes us believe that we are living in the presence at least for this short duration. And then we realize how it is that we should live every moment in the presence of the Lord. It's like, you know, water is everywhere. Yes, water is everywhere. It's in the air. Right now in the studio over here, in the air, there is water. But that doesn't mean that if I'm standing and watching the Niagara Falls, I won't say, this is just water. It's present even in my studio. Anybody will think that I'm a lunatic. You know? So though God is present everywhere, there are some places where that divinity decides to concretize itself. And we have Pandharpur, we have Badrinath, we have Kedarnath, we have Makkah, we have Jerusalem, we have, you know, Amritsar, we have different places where that divinity concretizes itself into a particular form. And just like the Niagara Falls is special, this place also becomes special. And that's why Prashanthi Nilayam is very, very, very special. You know, I was just thinking, and this is not like only for certain people. even in Islam, which believes in absolute kind of Advaita, formlessness, even they, when they pray, they turn to the West. Why? Why do you turn to the West? Why don't you turn to the East? Why don't you turn to the South? Because if you believe that Allah is everywhere, Allah has no form, is beyond everything, then why turn to the West? Why travel to Hajj?
Right,
why go
one
to
of the
Makkah?
Five mandates for
yes,
every
among the five
Islam,
mandates it is
right?
there. Why go there? Because all said and done, you know, there is something special in that kind of concretization. In that concretization, saying Kaaba, Hajj. There is some kind of spiritual benefit that accrues from it, and that is why this kind of concretization is special. That is what makes these pilgrimage places special. That's what makes Prashanthi Nilayam special. And I was thinking, you know, Prashanthi Nilayam, how special it must be. There's a Dargah in Kashmir, where apparently, you know, there's a hair of the Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say that a hair of the Prophet is there, and that's why that Dargah is very special or something like that. There is also many multiple villages, you know, in north of India, which there's one Charanpur, for example, which is special because apparently Rama stepped in that village during his exile.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an impression of his foot. That's why it's called Charanpur.
Okay.
And so that is very special because Rama walked there for some time. We went to a place called Baijnath.
Mm-hmm.
Baijnath, there's a magnificent Shiva temple there, multiple temples with the Shivalinga. And it's supposed to be special because before the wedding of Shiva and Parvati, the entourage of goddess Parvati stayed there at Baijnath. And that night Parvati worshipped Lord Shiva at Baijnath. So it's one night. One night, goddess Parvati stayed there and Baijnath is so special. Like that, if we see 55 to 60 years, 80 years, the Lord has walked. And you know, how special that must be. And when we take the other places of pilgrimage, it is only what we have heard from the ancestors, that Rama had come here, Krishna had come here, that Guru had been here. I don't know exactly, because they say that over 1,000 years, even a river changes its directions. River changes its flow, its path.
Right.
So what might have been the banks of Narmada 1,000 years or 2,000 years ago might no longer be the banks of Narmada today. But this is just what we have heard, we have read in the scriptures. But when it comes to Swami, we have got photographs. We have got video. We have got proof, you know, that Swami has walked exactly here. So, in that sense, how much more special must Prashanthi Nilayam be as a place that witnessed the concretization of that divinity in human form?
Very true. I think the very difference which we give to objects, and just going back to one discourse which Swami gave,
mm-hmm.
where he was talking about Advaita, because, you know, the whole confusion comes when you talk about Advaita, when you talk about omnipresence of the Lord. And Swami made a very important point there. He said Advaita is very important. But there are two forms of Advaita. Swami said there is what Swami says or what the masters teach us and what the scriptures ask us to follow is called Bhavadvaita. He said having Advaita in the feeling. Swami said there can never be Padartha Advaita. There cannot be oneness in objects. Objects will always be different. One will be greater than the other. One will be more important than the other. Simple thing is you can cut your nail and throw it off, but you cannot do that with other limbs of your body.
Mm.
There will always be difference when it comes to material objects. And when you talk about materials and when you talk about feelings, I think the difference is you're talking about your mind and your whatever
body.
Is that purest part inside you.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Right? Because it's the mind which sees the difference. It's the mind which sees the difference between a normal metal and gold. It's the mind which sees the difference between a piece of paper and probably a dollar bill. Because the difference is always in the mind. And it is the innermost, I think the purest self of us which believes the oneness. And our confusion is always the mind is trying to cloud this inner feeling of oneness.
Hmm.
And I feel all that you do in the form of worship, in the form of pilgrimage is a kind of, in a sense, cheating your mind and saying that, you know what, this place is very special. So you come in tune with my oneness, which is my reality. So though the mind actually is always revolting to accept this idea that this place is divine or right now you're in a divine place, I think when you go on a pilgrimage or when you stand in a temple and say that you kind of train your mind to think that this place is special. So you are, it's like that Pavlov's dog experiment.
Pavlov's dog.
Right.
Huh?
Where you're now training your mind to think that these are times when you have to be more silent. These are times when you have to be more accepting and forbearing.
that's definitely an advantage that a pilgrimage brings in us. You know, it helps us to focus on the important things in life. It makes us take a break away from everything, because so often we are lost in our day-to-day life, in the rote of life, in the rigmarole of life, that we never seem to have time to pause and ponder about the purpose of life, meaning of life, and find higher goals in life. See, we had this discussion on happiness where we realized that pleasure gives us happiness for some time. After that, it is engagement. Engagement is our work, our career, different thing, whatever we engage in, that seems to give us greater joy than pleasure, because of which we give up pleasures like eating or sleeping for the sake of engagement, that is our work or other things. But the complete and fulfilling kind of joy comes only from the third level, which is
having meaning.
Yes, right. meaning in life and purpose in life. Because of the purpose in life, we are ready to even give up engagement. So this kind of purpose in life needs some kind of pondering over to arrive at. And therefore, a pilgrimage does exactly that. It stops all our activities which have become day-to-day and makes us focus on objectives which will help, you know. So therefore, in that sense, a pilgrimage adds so much more to life, because it helps us discover the purpose or meaning in our life. This might vary from person to person, how one perceives the purpose or meaning, but definitely it is purpose or meaning in life that gives the greatest joy and satisfaction, contentment and fulfillment to a person, and a pilgrimage helps in focusing our attention towards this purpose.
Very true. Going back to that same, those three categories of happiness which you said, in fact, one of the things which Professor Seligman says is, when meaning is infused in any of these things, even if it is mundane pleasure, and if there is meaning in that, even if it is regular engagement or regular flow in your daily activity, and there is meaning in that, then it all gives you enhanced happiness.
Exactly. You see, I remember on Ugadi day, you know, we have something called Ugadi Pachadi. In Karnataka, where I hail from, we have something called Bevu Bella, in which they mix neem with jaggery, and you're supposed to eat it. You know, the jaggery part is tasty, but neem is really terrible.
Right.
In my life, I have never eaten neem as such. Only on Ugadi day, I eat it. And when I eat it, though I feel the bitterness, I don't feel sad, I don't feel yuck. The way you would feel normally when you eat. Why? Because I feel that this is prasadam. This, the neem what I'm eating is what the Lord has accepted as an offering, and then I'm getting to receive it. So along with it comes the Lord's blessing. You see, when you said that purpose and meaning make a pleasure more pleasurable, what I realize is, when there is a purpose and meaning, even something that is bitter and not so pleasurable also becomes acceptable and something that will give you joy. You know, after partaking that, you just feel good that I have taken the Lord's prasadam. A normal sweet, you may wonder whether it will cause you diabetes because you're diabetic. But I have seen so many diabetics gladly eating the prasadam that Swami gives in the mandir, saying that nothing can happen. You know, there's that kind of strong faith that nothing can happen because there's a Lord prasadam. This can't give me diabetes. So, as you said, that purpose is something that infuses so much more of fulfillment, even in pleasure and engagement.
And that also explains why you see, as you spoke about the chandeliers in the Kulunthal, why were festivals in Swami's presence so grand? Because it was meant to satisfy all your whole personality. It's not just that spiritual aspirant in you who has to come and see a Spartan arrangement and be thrilled by it. Because Swami's festivals or whatever happened here was engaging the entire part of you, the whole of you.
Yeah,
like
your ears, your eyes,
your everything is thrilled. Of course, the prasadam takes care of the tongue. And of course, when you say that there is a purpose to all of this, I think sometime back there was a comment on our Facebook page which said that, why do you waste so much money on the flowers which are put on Swami's Samadhi? I mean, these are all arguments which come out of very, very shallow understanding. Because when you look at it, when you come there, I don't know how many people feel the joy that I would have loved to, you know, decorate this space, this sacred space with that much flowers. Somebody has done it on my behalf. Somebody has done it for me. You know,
in fact,
right?
You know, I know that many devotees come and offer. They say that, can we get the chance of offering flowers for one day for the samadhi? And it's not actually available like that, but when some persistent requests are made, I think they give that opportunity also. It's almost like saying, why do you buy a video game for your child? You know it's addictive, you know it'll cause this. Why do you want to do that? Why do you buy toys? So many things that you do for the child. You know, you feel that it is worth, because the joy that you see that the child gets from that, you feel it's worth the expenditure. Though in the so-called pseudo-practical way, it's a waste of money. You say, shut up, it's not a waste. Why do you buy a teddy bear? It's going to rip. Haven't there been children who have grown up without teddy bears? Then why on earth do you buy a teddy bear for your child? You say, I can afford it, so I buy it. In the same way, we can afford flowers, so we put it. But actually, the inner reason is the joy that the child gets by playing with the teddy bear. You feel that that joy makes it worthwhile to make that, you don't consider it as an expenditure, but as an investment on a teddy bear. In the same way, the joy, you should just imagine you come to Swami Sannidhi and you see it bland without anything. How pained you feel. You want to see your Lord in the most beautiful splendor and glory. And therefore, if it is not there, you say, let me put flowers. So, as you said, all this is because it gives meaning to all, it gives meaning even to the sense enjoyments, it gives meaning even to the engagement.
In going the same line, you know, suppose you ask everybody agrees that a student is a good student whether he goes to school or not. You know, we have examples of so many intellectuals who were never schooled, you know, who were never put in an educational institution. They just blossomed because they were earnest learners. You know,
Swami would give the example of Abraham Lincoln.
Edison was homeschooled, it is believed, one of the greatest inventors. But still, why do we send our children to school?
Because, why waste money
right,
there?
Because when you take up an activity, a purposeful activity, you tend to give all your energies to it. You know, when you say that you might be walking up and down throughout the day, but when you go to a gym, you know, you're thinking that this is for a certain purpose. I'm doing this to achieve something. You kind of tend to put yourself into that activity. I think that is exactly what a pilgrimage is supposed to do. Because though you pray to God every day, though you probably say your night prayer, morning prayer, your Brahmarpanam every day, when you say, I'm going to Prashanti Nilayam, I'm going on a pilgrimage, I'm going on a Pratyatra or whatever, whichever place it is, you are putting yourself purposefully behind an activity. You're saying that this is for my spiritual progress, or this is for my, a kind of expression of my devotion or whatever it is. It is a purposeful move you're doing. And I think that is what makes anything like a puja or a worship or a pilgrimage very, very significant. Though God is everywhere, though whatever you do is worship.
Now, compared to an individual prayer at home, there's one more big benefit that a pilgrimage brings. It's akin to the difference between solo effort and teamwork.
Right.
You know, in a pilgrimage, you're with like-minded people, with similar goals, and it's anybody's guess to realize the benefits of like-minded individuals coming and working as a team. In science, they give the example of magnets. Every magnet have a dipole moment. And if, the magnetic material has dipole moment.
Right.
The difference between a magnet and a magnetic material.
Aligned in a non-magnetic, it's not aligned.
Exactly. Right. They cancel out each other. And when all of them get aligned, it becomes a powerful magnet which can even lift cars. So, that is the power of alignment and focus. And what we spoke till now was about the alignment and focus that this brings in. The added thing is the synergy that it brings in, because this kind of alignment and focus is not happening only to you or me, but to everyone along. And I remember Swami had once given in a discourse the difference between between Kirtana and Sankirtana. Mm-hmm. That is, singing alone and singing in a group. Swami had said that, imagine you're on a dark night, you're going alone on the highway. If your car headlights break down, you're stuck. You don't know what to do because you can't see the road ahead. But instead of one car, if there are 100 cars going together, even if your headlights break down, through the light that is being emitted from the other car headlights, you can still reach your journey. It so happens that, you know, in our own spiritual pursuits, we often encounter sadness, lows, depressions, frustrations. This is very common. It happens like in any other endeavor, even in our spiritual endeavors, we meet with this. But when we are along with like-minded people who are in the same endeavors, their own successes, their success stories, the way they are dealing with them, when we interact, what we learn from them, those will inspire us. And just like a car with a broken headlight can still make it to the journey, right, because it's with other cars, we too will be able to achieve our goal thanks to the like-minded people who will help us align and refocus.
I mean, another example which just comes to my mind is, you know, we all are actually below us there is water, let's say. You know, we all are dependent on the water table which is below the earth. But it's when somebody goes and digs a well, it becomes a ready source of water for everybody. I think that's precisely what happens. Though God is everywhere, a pilgrim center or a place of worship becomes like an opening from where you can actually harness this divinity which is there. It automatically draws people, and you know, that automatically brings the idea that I can go there and get what I want. And as you said, that it's that congregational effect which is there in a pilgrim center, which is so obvious. I think if you come and sit in Kulwant Hall, Swami would often say that, you know, this any place of worship, any place of, be it a temple or a church or a mosque, what gives that place the vibrations is the devotion of the people who come seeking whatever, you know, form of divinity they come there for. It is that devotion which gives that vibration to that place, and we go on pilgrimages to partake of that. You know,
exactly,
that
because imagine if we see Prashant and Liam now, for 60 to 70 years, it has been witnessing these kind of devotional congregations, and therefore it is a hub of this devotional energy. And every day we have people who come and pour out their devotion. So therefore, even if I'm making my first visit, that devotion is going to definitely capture me and enrapture my heart. So therefore, it becomes a center, a pilgrimage center. You know, this might be a slight side note on pilgrimage center, but I thought I should mention this because when we have this kind of Sukshma Baba and Subtle Baba going on at Muddenhalli, and people say you just go there and you can feel the vibrations. You know, therefore Swami is there. You know, Swami is there, Swami is everywhere, as we know. But if they say that, no, that Sukshma Baba exists there because, you know, you can feel the special vibration. I had been to Muddenhalli much before. And those vibrations are still there because Muddenhalli is not, Muddenhalli is a recent phenomenon. But Muddenhalli is not a new place. Swami has been visiting Muddenhalli from the 70s.
And apart from Swami visiting, I think it's a place where, as Swami would say, the Tyagajivis have been living. And those are people, I mean, we are talking about Prashant and Liam where we have visitors and, you know, we are here doing Swami's work. But the people who there at Muddenhalli, whom Swami used to refer to as Tyagajivis, were people who were young men who were, you know, masters and MPhils and PhDs, who had given up all kind of attachment to the world, they'd given up their families, and they were living like sannyasis there. And that was a place which has been, you know, it's filled with their devotion.
Exactly.
You know, how can you be there and not feel that love for Swami?
Yeah, so when, you know, I remember it was sometime 2002, I think, on our way back from Prashant and Liam, Swami had told that let all the boys stop at Muddenhalli. I feel it was a eye-opener for me to look at people who had nothing in the worldly sense and they were leading their life completely dependent on Swami. So, you know, I feel their combined devotion and love has created that ambience.
Right.
You take those people to any place on the world, that place will become like that and you will be able to feel it. It's just unfortunate that, you know, though you can create magnetism by aligning all the dipoles together, whether you use a magnet to good use, good ends or bad ends, that's totally left to you. It's just unfortunate that that is being said, that, you know, because you feel so wonderful there, therefore it has to be Swami. Even before the arrival of Sukshma Baba, I would like to say to any devotee who has just visited now, that dear devotee, even before the arrival of Sukshma Baba or the Subtle Baba, Muddenhalli was so beautiful and a wonderful place. It was that. It is very sad that that beauty, glory and grandeur and spiritual atmosphere that Swami had inspired in so many people is just being hijacked and being totally credited to, yeah, the Sukshma Baba or Subtle Baba. So, yeah, this was the aside that came. But coming back to the point, so therefore, a pilgrimage center becomes very special because it holds a conflagration of these feelings and love, and it has been holding that from centuries. And therefore, it resonates with that vibration. And when we come there with similar objectives, it will help us achieve those objectives faster.
And I think what you said was very important in the sense why we are looking at even this, you know, why should we go on a pilgrimage? What happens to us as individuals when we go on a pilgrimage is very important in so many ways, because it gives us an understanding of the working of our own mind. As, you know, someone was just asking why this kind of dress code in Prashanthi Nilayam, why so much of strictness with women wearing different kinds of clothes, why men are not allowed to wear shorts or sleeveless. You know, why is that important? It's all coming back to the same, that Pavlov effect which we spoke of, because when given an environment, you know, when given a certain set of stimuli for the senses, your mind automatically tunes to a certain kind of thinking. You know, why do we have these things of when you go to a temple, a bell is rung, you have the agarbatti which is lit up there. In South Indian temples, you get that strong fragrance of the camphor and the oil which is lit up in the lamps. Without your knowledge, the moment these kind of stimuli come to your senses, your mind is already telling you that you're in a temple. You know, you're in a sacred place. When you walk around in the ashram, when you see people who are dressed very modestly, when you see men and women dining separately, when you see that there is a certain amount of discipline which is maintained, whether you are a person who is spiritual or otherwise, or you're a person given to self-discipline or not, your mind automatically says that there are some things I can do, I cannot do in this place.
Exactly.
It stops playing. I think this is understanding which is very important, because, you know, I was talking to a very elderly person once. He said, I went to this particular ashram and they had these some particular kind of meditation. It was so thrilling. They, you know, it gave me so much of a feeling. And I was just telling him that if you go to any place, even I can teach you meditation and you will feel the same thrill, because it's not in me teaching you, it's in the thrill of meditation. Anybody can give you that thrill because it is you doing, and the act of meditation can give you happiness and give you that peace within. If we don't understand this, anybody can take us for a ride. Anybody can give us these conditions and make us believe that they are special because you are feeling this in their presence. And I mean, I think that is the flip side of going on a pilgrimage maybe. But the importance of realizing that this is what happens to us when you go on a pilgrimage gives us an idea of the value of a pilgrimage.
And that is the reason, you know, we were speaking of how similar-minded people come and create a whirlpool of this kind of vibrations, so that anybody comes, becomes easier to tune in with that vibration. Now, when you speak of luxuries, amenities in the ashram not being good enough for staying, now what I feel is, we are coming with vibes which are not matching this general whirlpool of vibrations that exist. So this is going to be out of sync and we have a jarring experience. And that brings us to the second part of our discussion. Maybe we'll take a quick break and come to that. A second part wherein we discuss as to what we should do on a pilgrimage so that we benefit from the pilgrimage. Rather than me coming to Prashanthi Nilayam, taking a room and saying, you know what, there's no geyser in this room. I don't get hot water. The bed is not comfortable. There are mosquitoes biting me. And I say that the pilgrimage was a horrible experience. Where did it go wrong? Why wasn't the pilgrimage as elevating for me as it was for somebody else? That has a lot to do with what expectations we come with and what is it that we are looking for from a pilgrimage. We'll go into that after this little break.
साई की ओर आओ चले सत्य साई की ओर जीवन को निर्मल करे आओ चले सत्य धर्म की ओर जीवन को पावन करे आओ चले हम सब साई हमारे जीवन सहारे साई हमारे जीवन सहारे जीवन को उज्जवल बनाने वाले तन मन में साई समाए उस साई रे चले सत्य धर्म की ओर और चले हम सब जीवन में कुछ भी पाना है तो
जीवन में कुछ भी पाना है तो शांति का सुख लाना है तो
तोड़ के बंधन जात और पात के काम क्रोध के लोभ मोह के
और चले सत्य धर्म की ओर चले हम सब
मानव सेवा ही माधव सेवा है ये दिव्य रीति तुमने सिखाई
सत्य साई
प्यासे दिलों
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing about pilgrimages and we had reached that point where we wanted to see what is it that we should do on a pilgrimage so that we benefit from the pilgrimage. Very often, we take a vacation and a pilgrimage for the same reason. That, you know, you feel some kind of emptiness in life, some kind of boredom, some kind of frustration, and you feel you want a break. Basically, you want a break. So, when you want a break, you either choose a vacation or you choose a pilgrimage. The mistake comes when we expect both to be the same. There is a fundamental difference between a vacation and a pilgrimage. Now, in a vacation, what happens is you go to a place where you're cut off from all these so-called worldly realities. You're protected, you're insulated, maybe you go to a resort, you take your mind away, you switch off your cell phones, you don't receive any work calls. You just, you know, kind of cut off from everything else for a while. Recently I had done that, you know, 3 days back I had taken a vacation for 2 days, I had gone to a resort, just relaxed, just did some swimming, just did some playing and came back. But you know, even after as I came back, I said, oh my God, I've got this thing to do, I have got this editing to complete, this work is there, so much, you know, it's back to the rigmarole. And it was just like, oh, how I wish those 2 days extended forever. You feel like that. Now that's a vacation. But a pilgrimage, on the other hand, it's not as if when you go, you're cut off from everything. In fact, it is more like a simulator where you are made to face the same life situations but in a kind of controlled atmosphere, in a controlled environment, along with help being given as to how you can battle this at a very fundamental level. It's not as if you will be trouble-free, you will not have any difficulties, you will have luxuries, you will be having amenities. No. You will have all the same difficulties, but you will be taught how to come out of it without having any, how to come out of it unscathed. And after a pilgrimage, when you return, it's not as if you enjoyed 5 to 10 days of absolute no problem. But after those 5 to 10 days, you are better equipped to face the realities of the world. You are now able to spend each day in a more peaceful manner. You don't, you know, that is the difference between a vacation and a pilgrimage. While a vacation is an external way of combating boredom, frustration, irritation, pilgrimage is an internal way. While a vacation becomes, while a vacation is created by changing all the external factors, a pilgrimage happens when you retune your internal factors so that the external factors don't bother you anymore. I think this is a vital difference that we have to recognize and understand.
What we say now might, it's not to justify things the way they are, in a sense, you know, in Parthi, you might, we've all faced that. We've seen people being little too rude to us, little too harsh to us, and saying amenities not being good enough. But many times when you think about it, I used to wonder, you know, can't Swami put the right people in the right places? You know, that's the question. You know, Swami knows the in and out of a person. When you are hiring a person, you don't know how that person will be. But if Swami is putting a person in a job, he knows exactly what that person is. Why can't Swami put the right person in the right place? I'm not saying this as a question, but the thing is, yes, we all face that thing of volunteers being rude or something like that. You know, many times when I think over it, let's say I have a face-off with a security person who's too harsh. You know, many times a person being like that also, in his mind, he's thinking that he's doing Swami's work the most efficient way. He believes that that time what he was doing is the best way to do the work which Swami has given him. And in a sense, what we are trying to do is cut out the differences which we see. Many times, you know, the way I think Swami's work should be done is different from the way you think Swami's work should be done. And are we able to look past those differences and see that what is the underlying thing is the love for Swami?
Exactly.
And why, that is why a pilgrimage is special, because a pilgrimage actually makes you go within. You know, when you're working in a business, when you're working in your day-to-day life, you're always trying to judge people. You know, this person is a, you know, he works like this, so I have to treat him this way. This person behaves like this, so I have to deal with him this way. But in the pilgrimage, you're trying to say that he may be different, she may be different, this person may be sweet, this person may be rude. But can I go past all that and look at that underlying devotion with which they're doing?
As I said, this is a pilgrimage differs from a vacation because it makes you change internally.
Right, you're supposed to go within.
Yes, when I do this, now if I've got a hard bed in Prashanthilyam when I came to stay, I met somebody who spoke rudely to me, if I'm able to remain unruffled in all this, I'm better prepared to meet the world, am I not? Instead of that, if Puttaparthi becomes a protective cocoon, it like any other vacation, the minute the vacation ends, you are again back to the world, you are unprepared. Why is it that we feel that after a visit to Prashanti, we are better geared to face the world? Because the visit to Prashanti, a pilgrimage to Prashanti, helps us realign our internal bearings so that we can face the world in a better manner. I feel it's very important we are discussing this now, because from Guru Purnima onwards, there is a lineup of Prashanti pilgrimages celebrating Swami's 90th year of Advent. International and countrywide yatras, Parthi yatras are beginning, and so many are happening even right now. For example, you know, just yesterday or day before, we had the Manipur children from the state of Manipur. Manipur is almost like Thailand, you know. It is definitely closer to Bangkok than it is to Puttaparthi. There's a narrow isthmus, there's a narrow piece of land connecting the northeastern part of India to the mainland of India. So, though you are closer to Puttaparthi, you will have to travel an extra 300 kilometers because you have to cross only in that narrow piece of land, because the other piece of land is Bangladesh or Bhutan. It's another country, you can't go without visa. So these children, it was so difficult for them to practice together because they were in different parts of Manipur and there was a kind of strike going on there. They managed to come, they managed to practice, and when they were traveling, because of the strikes, there was no single train available. They had to change train 4 times. They got in and off. They traveled for 3 complete days to reach Prashanthi Nilayam. It makes you wonder, why did they do that? You know, it shows that it doesn't mean, a pilgrimage doesn't mean that you will have physical comfort. A pilgrimage doesn't mean you will have emotional comfort. A pilgrimage only means that you will have spiritual growth. That is what Swami said in a discourse. I forget which one, it was sometime in the 60s, where Swami clearly said that Prashanti Nilayam has been made for spiritual growth. If at all you are looking for spiritual growth, then alone come here. If you are looking for anything else, please don't come. So when I complain and say the food is not...
Don't complain. I mean, what you're seeking is not here. What's the point in complaining?
Right. Exactly. What you're seeking is not here. When we spoke about every, you know, all that common feeling generating a whirlpool of those vibrations, in those there are no vibrations of money or comfort or... Because that is not here. If you want that, please go to Taj Hotels. Go to a resort. When I come and complain here saying that the food is not good, what did I expect? Three-star food? Five-star food? Then I was wrong. I should have gone to a three-star hotel. When I come and say here that what is it? You're not allowing me and my friend to stay together. It's policy. Swami has said that. You know, a man and woman, unless they're husband and wife, they will not be allowed to stay together. Even brother, sister don't stay together. Unless you're man and wife, you're not allowed to stay in the same room. Or unless you have a family. You have a husband, wife and children. That way it's okay. You come with friends. You know, three girls and three boys come together and they say, we are all friends, we are together, we want to stay together. What is this place you don't allow? No, sorry. This place is not for that. If you want, please go elsewhere. That's what I said. And that might be said rudely. If that is also said rudely, as you said, we should look at this as to how can I change things within myself so that this rudeness doesn't affect me? How can I change things within myself so that this hard bed doesn't affect me? In that sense, it helps us to prepare for the real world because, you know, believe it or not, our entire life is meant to be a pilgrimage, not just 10 days of a year.
I mean, that's the very idea of the whole thing because, you know, Swami would say, we all are moving from that presence to the omnipresence. It's not the other way around. It's not, as we said, we start with God is omnipresent, why do we have to go anywhere? Mm. But what Swami says is you start with that presence. You go to places where you feel the presence. You go to places where you can, you know, that is why Prashanti Nilayam, at the end of it, we can go back again and again and say that because this place is filled with so much of memories. This place is filled with thousands and thousands of devotees whose lives have been changed. You know, in the Tamil literature, you have this Periya Puranam, which is supposed to be a very, very auspicious piece of literature, where you have 66 devotees whose lives have been accounted, who have had one miracle in their life. You know, probably Lord Shiva would have come to them in the form of a ascetic, or would have given a vision, or some miracle would have happened. When we were speaking to one devotee, he was telling us that if you were to write a Periya Puranam of Swami's devotees, you know, how many lives will you chronicle in that? And each devotee has multiple accounts to say. And such dramas have happened in this place. This place is filled with, you know, when you say that devotion is gratitude, where else would have would you find so much gratitude being expressed here? How many thousands and millions of people have come here with that feeling of gratitude when their life was saved, when their children's lives were saved, when their, the businesses were saved? With how much gratitude people have come here and worship Swami. This place is that, you know,
epicenter
of all that. And that is why, you know, you start with the presence, and when you start with the presence, you're talking about a pilgrimage. And when you move to omnipresence, you are bringing in the idea that my whole life is a pilgrimage, and you're heading towards that one point of destination.
That's why I feel when we come to a place of pilgrimage, when we come to Prashanti, when we do our Prashanti pilgrimage, we need to have gratitude oozing in our heart, irrespective of what happens physically and mentally. We should have this conviction and faith that physically I may be suffering, mentally I may be suffering, but I am truly not suffering because that is my reality, my soul is progressing. That is why Swami brought me here. And therefore it will help if when we are on a pilgrimage, we always have an open mind. When we are open to experiences. And when, along with this open mind, I feel it will also help to have maybe an iPad or maybe a book and a pen, even a simple notepad, so that we make notes of things that strike us. Because this is a very special journey. When, as we have discussed, we have focused our mind, we have come into a place, and all this has happened. So there's a very, very high probability of some brilliant insights, ideas, and spiritual experiences happening to us. lest we lose them, it would be better to note them down, maybe as a voice record in the phone, maybe as a written diary entry, whatever it is. Because later on, these are the experiences, these are the insights that will stand us in good stead. So I feel gratitude in the heart, an open mind, and an active notebook and a pen to note down experiences are some of the basic things we should do when we are in Prashanti on a pilgrimage. Try to keep as silent as possible so that, you know, when we are speaking and when we are not silent, we are emitting. And when we are silent, we are absorbing. When we come on a pilgrimage, let us try to absorb as much as possible.
And really, these are the tips which are very, very important. I remember when we used to come from Vrindavan, you know, for us, in a sense, it was a pilgrimage. You know, every festival, we used to come from Vrindavan to Puttaparthi. And
as students.
Right, as students. I think you would remember that side, those buses will be waiting in the ground and there would be a mad rush to get the good seats.
Correct.
Right. I think at that time, one of our teachers was telling us, you know, you remember that where are you going? The moment you remember where you're going and what is waiting there at the end of that journey, which is you're going to have Swami's darshan, the moment you remember that, that will be the thought which will put in place all the other things which you would do after that. It's the way you would pack, the way you would, you know, you wouldn't go looking for the best seat in the bus. You'll be thinking that I'm going to see my Swami. You know, what would happen when I go and see Swami? Will Swami speak to me? Will I be able to speak to Swami?
We'll spend time in
contemplation. Right, when those things are there at the top of your mind, that will define every other process which is involved. As you said, you know, you might encounter different people here, difficult situations. The moment your focus is on why you are here, what have you made this trip for, I think that will define your reaction to every other thing which happens to you during a pilgrimage. And that is the best way to prepare for a pilgrimage too.
You know, the purpose, I really feel that as we discuss, the ultimate purpose of a pilgrimage is to make sure that life itself becomes a pilgrimage. We have pilgrimages in life so that one day we realize life itself is a pilgrimage where we are traveling. And when we look at life in that manner, then our life also will become a life worthy of emulation, worthy of inspiration. Because, you know, maybe it would be very apt to conclude our satsang paying our humble homage to one great son of India who recently breathed his last, Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam, an Indian president who occupied a very, very special place in everybody's heart, including Swami's heart. I remember during a discourse where Swami mentioned about him, where Swami said that he's a very special person. He is a simple heart which doesn't distinguish between people based on caste or creed or race. Though he is a Muslim by birth, he treats everyone lovingly. He has received all his knowledge in India. You know, these are the things that Swami mentioned in the discourse about this great son of India. And recently, when he was delivering a lecture at IIM in Shillong, doing something that he has loved doing all his life, which is teaching children, he just collapsed and he breathed his last. And the number of tributes that have poured in, you know, definitely convinces everyone that his life has been a wonderful pilgrimage, a pilgrimage that has met fulfillment definitely. Because as Khalil Gibran says, when you die, seek not a place in the bowels of earth, but a place in the hearts of men. A place in the bowels of earth everyone will get, but a place in the hearts of men, whether you'll get or not, we don't know. And Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam found a place not only in the hearts of men, but a place in the heart of God also.
I think it's a perfect journey we're talking about, Yatra, because when you say, when we are born, we don't choose the family we're born into, we don't choose the situations we are born into.
We don't choose the religion.
Right, and throughout our childhood, many of the choices which are given to us are not in alignment with our choices. You know, it would be probably appropriate to say that Abdul Kalam would say that he wanted to be a fighter pilot, which never happened. And there's that interesting episode which he says he goes to a saint who tells him that, you know, instead of feeling bad that the choice that you made has not found fulfillment, you put all your effort in what is coming your way and you will see what a great height you reach. And that's how he, you know, and he becomes a scientist, he works on missiles, then he becomes the head of DRDO, he becomes the advisor to the government, and finally the president. That apart, if you look at it, you know, when he was asked by a young journalist, "Sir, you've been in so many roles all through your life, what would you be like to be remembered for?" And very spontaneously, without thinking, he said, "I want to be remembered as a teacher." And he died when he was teaching. You know, what could be better than that? And I believe that apparently when he got an opportunity, he even prayed to Swami that he wants to have a painless passing. That's one of the prayers he made. And that's precisely, I mean, he was most active and he just dropped dead. And when, I mean, if you look at that journey, he did not have what he wanted. But he, at the end of it, he had everything that he chose. You know, he expected whatever he prayed for, that I want to be like this, I want to die like this, I want to live like this. I think he achieved everything. And that is what can happen when you are really living a life of focus and purity.
Yes, so dear listeners, we received multiple mails and requests from people saying that there should definitely be a tribute to this great devotee of Swami, Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam. We would like to inform that Professor G. Venkatraman sir is recording very soon a tribute to Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam. In the meanwhile, we just felt that it would be very apt that when we speak about life journeys, we should make a mention of this illustrious son of India, who definitely has had a fulfilling life journey, a journey that began and culminated to the source, to the Lord, to Swami. The discourse that I mentioned where Swami spoke about him was, I think, the November of 2002 during the convocation, where as the President of India, he was also the chief guest for that same convocation. With that, both Prem and myself offer ourselves humbly at Swami's lotus feet and pray that we live in the awareness that we reside at a place of pilgrimage. While there are so many things to be done for a pilgrim, as people residing in a pilgrimage center, I guess that the responsibilities are much higher. What is expected is much more. In fact, Swami has mentioned that also in a discourse which he delivered at Badrinath, one of the pilgrimage centers in India. But we will go into that possibly on some other occasion. So praying for that from the Lord, we offer this segment at His lotus feet. We will end with this song, the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
తంత్రులను మీటిన సాయి నీకు ప पादाभिषेकम् स्वामी रफ्ता रफ्ता बहती है नदी ये पावन रिश्ता अनोखा सा बंधन प्रेम प्रवाह बना तब दिल सराना तेरे लफ्ज हैं अब पहचान मेरो तेरे लफ्ज हैं अब पहचान मेरो मैं ही रफ्ता बहती है जिंदगानी ऐ हम सफर तेरे रहमो करम तेरे संग सजी मेरी कहानी रहमत का किस्सा करे रफ्ता रफ्ता बहती है